You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And top of the afternoon to you, my friends. Patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. A few days ago, actually, I've been saying this for some time, but ever since Mitt Romney has been wandering around Wisconsin with Paul Ryan, stuck together like president, vice president, Ryan just clearly, he's going to face a serious challenge in Wisconsin. He's a member of Congress. He's a member of the House of Representatives. All 435 members of the House of Representatives are up for re-election every 2 years. So, he's up for re-election. And he's not been doing, he's from a pretty solidly blue area, but still. So he's been kind of, saying, hey, Mitt, put me on a ticket with you. And maybe that's going to happen. Marco Rubio was the one we were all betting on until it came out that Marco Rubio was a Mormon for a couple of years. On the other hand, the Democratic Party just came out a couple of days ago and said, we are not going to even discuss Mitt Romney's religion, period. Not going to happen. So, excuse me, not that I think that they would have ever anyway, but, it's kind of putting their surrogates on notice as well, I believe. Don't go there. So maybe he will pick Marco Rubio. But anyhow, my point, the question that I've been asking is, ever since Romney endorsed the Ryan budget, Paul Ryan's budget, that voucherizes Medicare and that just basically, well, not basically, that totally strips the American government down to nothing but the military budget. 15, 20, 25 years out, you got nothing left. No EPA to protect the environment. No CDC to protect us against plagues nothing to protect us from corporate polluters. Nothing to protect us from stock shenanigans. The list goes on and on. They want to play the game, but they don't want any referees whatsoever. And they want to be able to write the rules. Sort of like having a football game where whichever team has the most money can decide where the goalposts are and how many downs they get. This is the Mitt Romney, Paul Ryan plan. So the question I've been asking, and I've asked it on the air here, and a number of you have tried to answer it, is how can Republicans run this fall without lying about where they stand? I mean, who's going to vote for this? What American outside of the top 1%? I get it. Paul Ryan wants to drop the top tax rate on the 1% from 35% down to 25%. Now, during the Bill Clinton administration, Bill Clinton jacked it up from 35 up to 39%. Actually, it was at 36. He took it up to 39%. Newt Gingrich, when Clinton did that, Newt Gingrich stood on the floor of the House of Representatives and said, if this passes, you will see a Great Depression in America like you. And not only did we not see a Great Depression, the economy boomed, and we got a balanced budget. In fact, we would have had a huge surplus budget had Al Gore been elected. Well, he was elected president. Had Al Gore taken the office of the presidency, Supreme Court notwithstanding, and continue those policies and just maintain that top tax rate. Half of the debt that was run up by Reagan, Bush, and Bush would be paid off by now. But instead, we got a couple of unpaid for wars, and Medicare can't negotiate drug prices and all this kind of stuff. So how are they going to run without lying? I've been asking this kind of rhetorically. Well, now we know the answer to the question. Mitt Romney yesterday gave a speech at the AP, the president, day before yesterday, gave this speech for the Associated Press here in Washington, D.C., at the, I think it was the National Press Club or whatever, the AP building, whatever it was. The president gave a speech there, and then Mitt Romney did the day later. The fact that they didn't invite Ricky Santorum, by the way, should tell you something, or Newt, or Ron Paul. But in any case, so Romney gave a speech, and he immediately began lying. Now, let me just tell you what the reality is first, and then I'm going to play this Romney clip for you. These guys are running around saying that the president is cut $500 billion from Medicare. Not true. Obamacare, if you want to call it that, the Affordable Care Act, cuts virtually nothing from Medicare. It cuts $138 billion out of Medicare Advantage. That's the privatized portion of Medicare that goes to the corporations. And by flipping it into Medicare, it takes out the profit motive, and it actually makes it more efficient. The Obama program, I mean, just very straightforward, is a program. It is a plan. There's this Independent Payment Advisory Board, IPAB, created by the Affordable Care Act. 15 Senate-confirmed experts with the authority to define the payment of Medicare if costs go above a certain point. Now, Paul Ryan agrees with that, by the way. But the Republican plan, backed by Romney and Paul Ryan, it's going to phase out Medicare altogether. In addition to that, there are substantial savings achieved in Medicare by looking at those areas where these for-profit companies are basically ripping us off and stopping it. And seniors right now are doing better, and young people, when they become seniors, will do better through Medicare because the donut hole is closing. They're paying less for their drugs. They're receiving preventative care right now as a result of this. And the proof that this is actually helping Medicare Advantage, or at least those people on Medicare Advantage, is that enrollment is up and premiums are down. Because Obamacare says you must give 80% of all the dollars you get, you must use that to pay for health care, among other things. So you get it, that it is an absolute lie to say that the president has cut anything out of Medicare. In fact, he has strengthened Medicare. Here's Mitt Romney yesterday.
But he doesn't have one. That's right. 3.5 years later, he has failed to enact or even propose a serious plan to solve the entitlement crisis. Instead, he has taken a series of steps that end Medicare as we know it.
Lie.
He is the only president to ever cut $500 billion from Medicare.
Lie.
And as a result, more than half of doctors say they will cut back on treating seniors.
Lie.
He's destroying Medicare Advantage, eliminating the coverage
Lie.
That millions of seniors depend on, and reducing choice by two-thirds.
Lie. By the way, doctors are going to practice, are going to be refusing to take patients. That was a study that was done 2.5 years ago where they asked doctors, you know, if these things happen, will you? And some doctors said, yeah, I'll start refusing to take those patients. When they looked back at that, not only did that the results of that not come true, but, I mean, you know, is this one of these right-wing think tanks? It ain't happening. This was a series of lies that Mitt Romney told with a straight face and were reported to the American people by the docile American press corps as something other than lies. They're lies. There's no other word to describe them. He knows they're not true. Probably about a third of the reporters in that room knew that they weren't true, and all of them should have if they simply bothered to do their homework. His advisors, Romney's advisors and speechwriters, know that they're not true, but what they're betting is that if they tell enough lies between now and November, that Mark Twain was dead on right. You know, a lie can get halfway around the world before the truth gets its boots on. Or that Goebbels was right. You tell a big enough lie and you tell it often enough, people will believe it no matter how absurd it is. Welcome to the era of the big lie, also known as the Romney campaign.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Not only that, there's some major frame shifting going on that has to do with education and young people going to college. I got to tell you about that right after this.
Tell me lies, tell me sweet little lies. Tell me lies.
Actually, you know, I'd rather not have the lies. I'd rather have a political discourse. We've played clips, in fact, on this show of the Nixon-Kennedy debates. Their positions were right out there for everybody to hear. In fact, Jacob, if you can easily find that clip between Nixon and Kennedy about civil rights, that was just it was so vivid. You really get it. Richard Nixon basically said, you know, the question was, what are you going to do? The Supreme Court has mandated integration. We've had in the United States for hundreds of years legal segregation, and before that slavery. What are you going to do? This is now the law. And Richard Nixon says, I'll bring in the department store heads, you know, because this was integrating lunch counters and things. He says, I'll bring in the heads of business and we'll have them talk to each other and I'll have a good talk with them. And Kennedy says, I'm going to kick their ass with the law. Pardon my English there, but I mean, he just basically said, yeah, well, this is not the economic one. This is here you go. Listen to this. This is how debates used to be.
I have talked to Negro mothers. I've heard them try to explain how they tell their children how they can go into a store and buy a loaf of bread, but then can't go into that store and sit at the counter and get a Coca-Cola. This is wrong, and we have to do something about it. So under the circumstances, what do we do? Well, what we do is what the Attorney General of the United States did under the direction of the President. Call in the owners of chain stores and get them to take action.
So Nixon's solution was, I'm going to jawbone it. I'm going to sit down with the owners of these chain stores and beg them to be nice. Here's what Kennedy said.
Senator Kennedy.
Well, Mr. Nixon hasn't discussed the two basic questions. What is going to be done and what will be his policy on implementing the Supreme Court decision of 1954? Giving aid to schools technically that are trying to carry out the decision is not the great question. Secondly, what's he going to do to provide fair employment? He's been the head of the Committee on Government Contracts. It's carried out two cases, both in the District of Columbia. He has not indicated his support of an attempt to provide fair employment practices around the country so that everyone can get a job regardless of their race or color. Nor has he indicated that he will support Title III, which would give the Attorney General additional powers to protect constitutional rights. These are the great questions. Equality of education in schools. About 2% of our population of white people is illiterate. 10% of our colored population. 60 to 70% of our colored children do not finish high school. These are the questions in these areas that the North and the South, East and West are entitled to know. What will be the leadership of the President in these areas to provide equality of opportunity for employment? Equality of opportunity in the field of housing, which could be done on all federal-supported housing by a stroke of the President's pen. What will be done to provide equality of education in all sections of the United States? Those are the questions to which the President must establish a moral tone and moral leadership. And I can assure you that if I'm elected President, we will do so.
And he was, and they did. And after he was assassinated, his vice president did, to a large extent, Lyndon Johnson. But that was back in the day when politicians actually, I mean, Richard Nixon just came right out and said it. Hey, I'm a Republican. I'm going to leave it up to the free market. I'll talk to these guys. I'll ask them to be nice to those African-American people who, you know, I'll ask them to be nice. I know this is a tough one. Kennedy says, hey, stroke of the president's pen. Law. But now it's not so easy. Now people don't actually say what they intend to do. They don't, you know, and here's Mitt Romney lying about this. Meanwhile, frames are in use. For example, with health care. Well, actually, there's a couple that I wanted to share with you. One has to do with education, with college education. There's a great piece over on Alternate. You can read this. Sarah Robinson, I believe, wrote it. And she talks about how how Ricky Santorum the other day came out with this kind of bumbling, stumbling. In fact, I think we played this clip yesterday, Jacob, or we had this clip. Rick Santorum came out with this kind of bumbling, stumbling thing about how they don't teach history in the University of California anymore. And it's a lie. Well, there's some truth to it. There's actually a couple of schools in the University of California that don't teach history. They're the medical schools. Here's Santorum.
And at the California universities, it's several, I think it's seven or eight of the California system of universities, don't even teach an American history course.
Yeah.
It's not even available to be taught.
Yeah, but how dare they? Now, what's really going on here is this is dog whistle. He's not complaining about that. You know, he probably knows that those are medical schools. What he's saying to his base is California colleges, and his base hears Berkeley, hippies, 60s, liberals, Ronald Reagan hated them, Ronald Reagan ended free education at the University of California. That's what his base is hearing. What he's saying is we need to take down public education and replace it with for-profit education. Profitize, privatize our nation's colleges. So much for these land-grant universities that Abraham Lincoln came up with that were free, or the University of Virginia that Thomas Jefferson put into place that was free. We can't have that. I mean, none of them are free now anymore, any longer, but they're heavily subsidized. Oh, we can't have that. It's not in a profit motive. That's one frame. The other frame is the healthcare frame. You know, we all are paying for our healthcare right now, and we're giving that money to big health insurance companies, and they're taking the money. Here's Frank Luntz advising Hannity on how Republicans should be talking about Obamacare.
What would you suggest?
Who's going to pay for this?
I like that.
The healthcare legislation. Who in the end is going to pay for it? These programs that help everyone in every state across the country for years. And who's going to pay for it? You ask that question again and again, and it puts the focus and the pressure where it belongs in the White House.
Actually, what it does is it basically says everybody knows government programs are paid for with your taxes. So you keep asking who's going to pay for it, without even mentioning the fact that we're all, anybody who's insured is already paying for it, and anybody who isn't insured is screwed. Frank Luntz playing the word game. Hannity, oh, I like that. Yeah. This is the twisting of reality.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's called Using Frames. I wrote a whole book about it called Cracking the Code, about how this is done, and we're seeing it right now as we go into this campaign. There's now a free app for the Tom Hartman Program at the App Store. You can listen, watch, and read our newsletter, plus the Daily Stack there.
You better tell me the truth.
Jacob with his ever-brilliant bumper selections. Perfectly apropos for the day. Jacob Dean, our associate producer, making the music happen. Now, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the airwaves 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time, Monday through Friday, and having a fine time doing it. The banksters and the technocrats that have taken over Greece now officially have blood on their hands. 77-year-old pharmacist walked up to the parliament building, or close to it. He got 100 yards or so away from it and shot himself in the head. Left behind a note to his daughter in which he said that he was taking a... He pointed out that for 35 years, without any government assistance whatsoever, he had paid into a pension plan that is funded by the government, that was run by the government. In other words, the equivalent of Social Security. It was like saying, I've paid into Social Security for 35 years. But the banksters, Papademos, let's see, Papandreou was the elected prime minister of Greece, and he got kicked out by the European Union and by the banksters, and he was replaced by this guy Papademos, who used to be the head bankster for Greece. And he's now the prime minister. He was not elected by anybody, and they've been, and he's imposed all these trickle-down austerity measures, including slashing the Greek version of Social Security. And this guy says in his suicide letter, I paid into this program for 35 years, and now I'm going to take a graceful way out before I have to start rummaging through the garbage looking for food. And the Greeks are pretty upset. And that same kind of trickle-down austerity that has been imposed on Greece by the banksters is what Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney want to do to the United States. It doesn't work. It never has. But this is what they want. This is what they want to bring us. And every Republican except 10 in the House of Representatives voted for this just 2 weeks ago. Meanwhile, you ever eaten a Twinkie? I think probably everybody says, yeah, I've had it, you know. I remember Twinkies. Twinkies were wonderful. I mean, when you're 8 years old, you know, there's just... But they're not, it appears, so wonderful. The Hostess Brands Company, which makes Twinkies, was run into the ground, apparently, by its CEO, Brian Driscoll. And as this company was heading right toward that wall of bankruptcy, what did Brian Driscoll do? What did the CEO and his senior executives do with the Twinkie-making company? He refused to fund the pensions that had been promised to the workers. Speaking of pensions, refused to fund it, refused to put the money in so that they could draw retirement, and instead gave himself a 300% pay raise, took $2.5 million out of the company, emptied the cash out of the coffers, and then bankrupted the company. Him and a bunch of senior executives. At least according to Dow Jones. Or at least according to a read of the bankruptcy filings reported by Dow Jones. Connecticut, by the way, is ending the death penalty. Good news. So, anyhow, lots of stuff going on in the world. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Jane in Modesto, California. Hey, Jane, what's on your mind today?
I'm calling because I'm concerned about the possible repeal of the health care law. And I think there hasn't been enough attention paid to the fact that there are so many costs associated with it that deal with people being pulled into our criminal justice system. My husband and I are both attorneys, and what we're seeing is a huge uptick in people being charged with crimes who would not be committed crimes, were they receiving the type of medical care that they needed. And my case in point, and what really pushed me to call, I've never called before, but I had a case come to me yesterday of a young man who needs medication. He has just been diagnosed with a schizophrenic disorder. His medication costs $4,000 a month.
Wow.
That's $48,000 a year. Most Americans don't even make $48,000 a year.
Right.
And so unfortunately, with his family working extremely hard and trying to help him, he was unable to get his medication. And then it was not a violent crime. That's all I can tell you at this point. But he is now incarcerated. Taxpayers are going to be paying for that. In the meantime, he's not getting care that he needs. And we've also seen a huge number of cases of PTSD for returning veterans. And it is heartbreaking. Sure. And it is immoral, in my opinion, that we cannot get these people the care they deserve and that they need.
Yeah, this should be a basic human right. Did this young man commit a crime in order to get in jail so he could get health care? Or is he now, he committed a crime and he's now in jail and he's not getting the health care he needs? I'm not quite sure I understood which of those two you were asserting.
It was the latter.
He committed
a crime because he was not getting the medication. He was not on the proper medication, and so as a result was having a schizophrenic episode.
Oh, I see. It was medication for mental illness.
Correct.
I see. And in an unmedicated state, he committed a crime, and now he's in jail, and he's not getting treated. I got it. Jane, thank you for sharing the story with us. It is a story that everybody needs to hear, and we do need to do something about this. And it also makes the second point, which is that the brain is part of the body, and that mental illness is just as real as physical illness, and we need to be covering all of it universally for every American in a completely comprehensive way. You know, when Ronald Reagan ended mental health care in the United States and closed institutions, and thus we had this explosion of homeless people in the 1980s, it's just been downhill ever since then. You know, Ted Kennedy tried to do something about that, but it was only moderately successful. Jane, thank you for the call. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Jeff in Bayville, New Jersey. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? It's an absolute honor to speak with you.
Thank you.
I'm listening to television, and I hear the legal scholars insisting that Madison versus Marbury is uncontestable and irrefutable, and I've read your book, and from what I understand, that it's a misinterpretation of the result of that case that was written by a someone who worked for the court.
You're mixing up two different cases. In 1886. In a case called Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, the argument was made by, and this was after the Civil War and after the 14th Amendment was passed, which says no person shall be denied equal protection under the law. The railroads made an argument before the Supreme Court, among others. They made five arguments. One of their arguments was that because they paid different tax rates in Santa Ana County and Santa Clara County, that was unequal protection. That was not equal protection under the law. And as a person, they were being denied their constitutional rights. The court did not rule on that. In fact, they explicitly in the decision, at the very end of the decision, explicitly said, constitutional issues are presented in this case. We chose not to rule on them because we could find the remedy in California law. So it was not a constitutional case. But the clerk of the court, John Chandler Bancroft Davis, a former railroad CEO and the son of the former governor of Massachusetts, very wealthy patrician family and lineage, he, in his commentary on the case, the headnote, he wrote that the Chief Justice had said the corporations are people, and that has been, and that was picked up by the Supreme Court, has been kind of policy and now law ever since. Marbury versus Madison was in 1803, and that was a case where James Madison refused, as Secretary of State under Thomas Jefferson, refused to deliver to Mr. Marbury the papers that made him a justice of the peace. And therefore, he wasn't under a law that had been passed, the Judicial Act, as I recall, of 1798. And I may be off a year on that, but in any case. And the Supreme Court ruled in Madison's favor in that, Justice John Marshall, the Chief Justice. So the president, Thomas Jefferson, couldn't appeal it, but what he did was he struck down the law, and Jefferson agreed with striking down that law. He didn't think it was a constitutional law, but he didn't think that the Supreme Court should be the one to strike it down. He thought Congress should strike it down or the president should veto it. And, cause that's what the Constitution calls for. So there's a big discussion now because the president came out a week or so, or earlier in the week, I guess it was, and said, you know, he wasn't concerned about the health care law going down in flames before the Supreme Court because nine unelected justices are not going to undo the will of the people, which, you know, then gets all the Fox News talking heads going, what? Doesn't he know about Marbury versus Madison, this precedent established in 1803 when the Republic was only 20 years old or thereabouts? And doesn't he realize that the Supreme Court has had this power ever since then? Well, they took it onto themselves. I don't think they should have that power. Jefferson didn't think they should have that power. But they do have that power, at least by virtue of precedent. And as long as Congress continues to acknowledge it and the presidency continues to acknowledge it, they retain that power. There have been attempts to push back. Andrew Jackson pushed back and refused to enforce a ruling of the Supreme Court, successfully refused to. Abraham Lincoln tried to push back, and Franklin Roosevelt tried to push back, and using Article 3, Section 2, trying to regulate the court by an act of Congress. None of them were successful, and I think it's high time that somebody does. This is one of my regular rants. But, Jeff, thanks for the call. Both those cases that you mentioned, the Marbury versus Madison case and the Southern Pacific Railroad versus Santa Clara County, those two cases are probably two of the most important, the most seminal Supreme Court cases in the history of this country that changed us, arguably, from a democratic republic to an aristocracy.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Where the aristocrats are the corporate barons, the CEOs, and those who have great inherited wealth.
To lie takes a liar, it's to steal takes a thief. To lie to the whole world takes a liar in chief. He lies and he lies and he lies. He lies and he lies and he lies.
Yeah, well, you know, we'll see. Welcome back. I think that was from the Bush era, wasn't it? Oh, it's for Romney. Okay. Dan in Chehalis, Washington. It says you disagree with me. You're up next. What's on? What's up?
Hi, Tom. I don't disagree with you. What I wanted to call and talk to you about was the fact that I listened to look on websites and everything, and I see clips from the Republicans saying that when Bush was in office, there was no control over oil prices due to him, but right now, Obama is responsible for everything. We need to keep playing these clips over and over again.
Uh-huh.
From Fox News and all these are faux news that I like to call them,
yeah.
and play them over and over again to sink in the propaganda to let people know that this is not the problem of the president. It's a problem with the global market and to...
Well, however, there, at a certain point, I wish I had the names in front of me. I keep saying I'm going to get them and bring them in. They're in a book that I'm writing right now. There were these two guys who back during 2008 when the price of oil hit $147 a barrel, I think was the peak. These two guys had, these two Wall Street traders, banksters on Wall Street, hedge fund managers, they had cornered the oil market. They had something like 60 or 70% of all the oil future contracts that were available in the United States in the market. And that's what drove the price of oil up. Now, George Bush as president could have ordered the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC, to stop that, even though, you know, they used to have that authority to stop that, and it was taken away by the Enron loophole that was pushed through by Phil Graham in 1999 or in 2000. And but he could have still, you know, I mean, as the president, as the head of the head of the executive branch, which runs that agency, arguably he could have done something about it or spoken out about it. Similarly, right now, you've got banksters running the banksters who own over 70% of the total futures oil futures market in the United States, which affects the entire worldwide price of oil, is the largest futures market in existence. And we consume a quarter of all the oil on the planet. You've got banksters running 70%, whereas 2 years ago when the price of oil was a third of what it is right now, they only had 30%. And people are calling, and there's Democrats who have introduced resolutions into Congress, at calling on the president to fire Gary Gensler, who is the head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, because he's refusing to, or he's not going forward with enforcement of, in putting into place and enforcing rules that say that the banksters can only own up to a certain, you know, I think the percentage is 20%. Banksters can only play that game at 20% of the market, and the rest of the market has to be actual what are called counterparties, real producers of oil and real consumers of oil. We're seeing the same thing happen right now that we saw happen during the Bush presidency, and it hurt George Bush, and it crashed the world economy, some economists say. And I think it's going to hurt President Obama, and it has the risk of crashing the world economy again. And it's mystifying to, I think, everybody as to why the CFTC isn't doing this, although we have to acknowledge the fact that the Republicans in Congress have refused to allow the enabling legislation. I mean, the enabling legislation has passed. The funding legislation has not passed. So Gensler is arguably dealing, you know, he's got the power, but he's got nobody to carry out his commands. He's got nobody to do the work because the Republicans block the efforts to fund it. But well, still, you would think that they could pull something.
The oil.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it's a complicated thing, and it's something that's not easily reduced to a soundbite, but something I think everybody needs to understand. John in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom. Well, a couple things. Are you still going to have the guy on later to debate you about the changing of history?
I think so. No, okay. No, I'm not. He's not going
to
be on.
Okay. Well, I had a point for you to go against him with. But my big thing for calling you, yesterday you had a big discussion over drug testing, people applying for public assistance. And there's something, my wife works for the Department of Child Services, and I've given you Columbus, Ohio, but that's not where I live. I live somewhere in the Midwest because I don't want to use any anecdotal information to breach confidentiality and get her in trouble.
That's fine.
But, I have a lot of problem balancing, because I believe much the same as you do, is it's very much an imposition on the poor. But at the same time, using your analogy of, I don't want somebody who's going to endanger me, you know, on the road or using equipment or something, I use much that same analogy with kids, because my wife's working for the Department of Child Services. We've got people, like she's on call this week. She got called out last night on a case where these parents had been using their kids. They're on public assistance. We're at the fourth of the month. They got their card refilled the first of the month. They already don't have anything on the card because they took their drug dealer to the supermarket, loaded up the cart, and gave him everything in the cart so that they could get their drugs for free. He gives them, like, you know, a quarter on the dollar of that. They take their kids, they take them around, and all that. How do you balance that?
Where is the 765 area code?
That's in Indiana.
Okay. Because, first of all, I mean, I've worked with DCYF, is what it's called in New Hampshire. Louise and I ran a community for abused kids for 5 years. We saw the worst of these kind of cases. I mean, we got the kids that couldn't make it in foster care. And I can tell you from personal experience that the story that you're telling is the classic Ronald Reagan welfare queen story that was told in the 80s and is told over and over and over again by conservatives to justify cutting off benefits to poor people. And does happen, but rarely. That's the exception, not the rule.
Tom, I know
parents like that should be thrown in jail, or they should be, you know, there should be some penalty for that. I'm not suggesting there shouldn't be.
No, I understand that, and I'm not debating that point. But what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to balance.
I think what you're trying to do is you're trying to get out a very bizarre Republican talking point, and I frankly, you know, I have a hard time believing that your story is even true. We'll be right back. I mean, anybody can call it radio and TV show, right? We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. In 2008... a police officer by the name of Officer Anthony Corelli, apparently shot or brutalized, beat a person under his. I'm not sure how you say this. He beat up a guy, and is charged with police brutality. In fact, he's going to court shortly. In this 2008 police brutality case. This is the guy, apparently, if I have this right, who is the police officer who killed 68-year-old Kenneth Chamberlain, whose story we talked about earlier in the week when this first came to light. On the line with us is Randolph McLaughlin, who is the attorney for the Chamberlain family, and Kenneth Chamberlain Jr., the son of the 68-year-old retired Marine who was shot to death by this police officer. And let me, gentlemen, welcome both of you to the program.
Thank you. Hello. How are you?
Thank you. I'm fine. First of all, Mr. McLaughlin, as the attorney, have I asserted anything here that's not factual?
Well, just to give a little more detail.
Sure.
Mr. Corelli's name was revealed today in an article by Juan Gonzalez of the Daily News, who actually dug out this name and the case against him. He has been identified by the police commissioner in White Plains as the officer who shot and killed Kent Chamberlain Sr. After an hour-long siege at Mr. Chamberlain's door. Literally, they lifted the door off the hinges and just came in and, without any provocation, shot and killed him. Mm-hmm. Turns out that Corelli had a similar incident, only he didn't kill this person. Arrested two individuals who were of Jordanian descent, and while they were in handcuffs, at least one of them, the complaint charged that Corelli beat the man and kicked him in his groin and called him raghead, which is a slur against people of Arab descent.
Sure.
Now we know why they didn't release his name, because they knew they had a problem cop on their hands,
yeah.
And they didn't want this getting out, that this was the person who shot and killed Mr. Chamberlain.
That's amazing. Kenneth Chamberlain Jr., you're first of all, thank you for joining us on the program, sir.
Thank you.
You are it must be very difficult to have your father killed in this fashion. He had a medic alert thing, you know, what do you call it, necklace, whatever, in the
pendant,
thank you. That went off and summoned help, and tell us about the help that he got.
Well, the help that he received wasn't help at all. The people that were sworn to protect him actually came and shot and killed him. Mm-hmm. And for my family, of course, you know, no one would ever think that they would lose a family member this way. I mean, that's the last way that anybody wants to lose a family member. Mm-hmm. And then for the fact that even from the beginning, the spin that the police department put on it in the news where they said police fatally shoot hatchet-wielding man, you would think that it's someone in the street running around trying to harm people, when in fact my father was in his home, accidentally triggered the pendant. They arrived. He said to them that he was okay. He did not call them, yet they insisted on getting in his home, and he refused to let them in. And then they used expletives and racial slurs, and then ultimately shot and killed him. And I've asked over and over again to reveal the name of the officer that was involved in the shooting, and they did not want to give it to us. But due to the investigator reporting, as my attorney said, from Juan Gonzalez, it turns out his name was Anthony Corelli, and he has other charges pending right now.
Right. Well, Kenneth Chamberlain, Jr., my wife's grandmother was in her 90s, and she had one of these medical alert pendants. And about once a month, she used to accidentally set the thing off, and people would come to her apartment. She was never shot. She was white. Your father was African American. Do you believe that that plays a role in this?
Well, it is a component in this, I believe, and it's a very serious one. But at the same time, I've always said that it's not just looking at the fact that it's police officers shooting or killing men and women and children of color. It's more of a police misconduct thing, brutality mm-hmm. and criminality, and that you have some officers that should not be that. They mm-hmm. should not have guns or badges, because they feel like with that they can do whatever they want to do to whomever they want, and there is no recourse for it. There is no accountability. And hopefully, with this situation getting so much attention, maybe it will bring about some type of change where they'll start to put these networks together for police accountability and criminally indict these officers so that they let them go to jail just like anyone else.
Yeah, yeah. And I want to say, Mr. Chamberlain, I'm so sorry for your loss, and I'm sure our viewers and listeners would extend that if they could. Attorney McLaughlin, how can something like this happen? How can we prevent this from happening again to someone else's father or child?
Well, I think that what's critical in these types of cases, and what we're trying to see whether it even happened in White Plains, is that when you hire officers, you need to screen them psychologically to make sure that they don't have anger management issues. And if you find out during the course of their employment that they do have those issues, get them the help that they need so they don't subject the public to brutality and death. And furthermore, the officers need to be trained in how to deal with a variety of situations that they will come in contact with. For instance, they're at this door. They claimed Mr. Chamberlain was emotionally disturbed. Well, then how should you respond to someone like that? If that's what you believe is going on, do you bang on his door for an hour? Do you taunt him? So I really lay the blame in two places. One, at the feet of that officer who pulled the gun. Two, at the feet of the supervisors who were there with him and did nothing to control the situation or to control their subordinates. And three, at the feet of the city of White Plains that failed to train these officers and make sure they knew how to perform their jobs so that the public was safe.
You know, it seems that in those societies where police officers and teachers, the people who are entrusted to our safety and our future and with whom we entrust our future, are well paid and there are very high standards to become a police officer or a teacher, those societies seem to function quite well. I'm thinking in particular of Scandinavian societies. Whereas those societies like the United States, where police officers and increasingly teachers are becoming more and more poorly paid jobs, and state governments are trying to even take away their rights to collectively bargain, as we're seeing across the Midwest, this has to lead to a downward spiral in the quality of the people in the police force.
I think it's certainly demoralizing. I mean, for the longest time, we had a notion in police hiring that we want to professionalize our police force, mm-hmm. to require that they have a college degree, which I thought was an excellent idea to make sure that these officers were exposed to a variety of issues and types of people and not just living in small, little, monochromatic, isolated communities and then having to come into the big city and police people that don't look like them.
Right.
But I'm really worried about where we're going with the labor issues, and really the attack on labor may actually work to lead to teachers who are not as qualified and officers who are not as qualified.
Yeah, I think this is the case. Mr. Chamberlain, Mr. McLaughlin, thank you both for coming on the program and sharing your stories with us. And Mr. Chamberlain, in particular, our very best wishes to you and your family. Please pass the
ball. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. This has got to be a really, really, really tough thing to go through. I just can't imagine. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Coming up next, geeky science. Yes, they think they've discovered why the bee colonies are collapsing.
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school. And proud. Paleoanthropology.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And our geeky science moment here, two or three minutes every week on Thursday in the second hour of our program when I have a chance to talk about my second favorite topic, science behind politics. Or maybe religion. I don't know. You take your pick. Anyway, two different studies done in Europe. The first one was done in the United Kingdom at the University of Stirling. And the second one was done in France, at the Institute for Agricultural Research, INRA. And in the first study, what they did is they looked at areas where pesticides were used. Well, in fact, let me set this up. First of all, we have this problem. It's called colony collapse disorder. And in this article in USA Today, Dan Vergano writes, since 2006, U.S. beekeepers have reported unusually severe winter losses from honeybee colonies, 33% or greater, with about a third of the losses directly attributed to the syndrome, colony collapse disorder. And it appears that what happens is these bees, they get disoriented, they don't come back to the colony, or they don't bring back pollen the way they're supposed to. They just don't behave the way they're supposed to, and the colony ends up starving to death. It collapses during the winter, dies. So the first study was kind of an epidemiological one. They were looking at where are the pesticides put out, and how are the bees behaving as a consequence of it? And after 6 weeks, they were looking at these bees that were dosed with these insecticides, principally the nicotinoids, which are insecticides made out of nicotine, stuff that they extract from tobacco. After 6 weeks, they found that the dosed hives, this is from the USA Today story, were 8 to 12% smaller than the others, and more importantly, they only produced 15% as many queen bees. So that was the UK study. In fact, the one entomologist, Dave Goulson of the UK's University of Stirling, says certainly it looks like these herbicides, insecticides, are one important mechanism in the problem. The second one at the Institute for Agricultural Research in France, they actually dosed the honeybees and then tracked them, and these bees died at 2 to 3 times the rate of bees who were not dosed, and the way they died was by basically just never coming back. They lost their way. So it seems that these insecticides, they don't actually kill off the bees, they disorient them, or they lose their homing mechanism or something. We still don't understand the details. But without pollinators, without bees pollinating our crops, we're screwed, because all life, or at least all complex life, all mammalian life, depends on pollinated foods. I mean, you know, plants have to have pollen in order to produce grains, in order to produce fruits, in order to produce nuts, in order to produce seeds, in order to reproduce themselves. And bees are major pollinators. Do away with the bees, you got a serious problem. Nature saying, no thanks. Chris in Amherst, Massachusetts, listening to WHMP. Chris, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I wanted to talk about the Florida drug testing of the welfare people.
Yeah.
I was wondering, I'm not sure if this has been brought up yet or not, but were the legislators who made that law, were they drug tested?
No.
And was the governor of the state who was in charge of you know, billions, you know, was he drug tested? And
no, he makes money on drug testing.
You know, those drug tests. I mean, sports people are drug tested. You know, are presidential candidates drug tested?
No.
Or is the president himself, is he drug tested? I mean, I'd want to know if my president is on all kinds of pills or, you know, I think the public.
Actually, Jack Kennedy was. You know, Kennedy was taking, he had Addison's disease, and this was before they had discovered cortisone. Addison's disease is a disease of the adrenal glands where they basically atrophy and die, and you lose the hormones that are produced by the adrenal glands, and typically by the age of 35 or 40, you die. And
right.
They discovered cortisone as a cure for, you know, as the replacement hormone that was being produced by the adrenals in the late 1950s, early 1960s. I think it was the late 1950s. I think it was the second time that Kennedy ran for Congress. And up until that point, they fully expected him to be dead in the next 4 or 5 years. So he had that. Plus, he had broken his back when his PT boat got, you know, blown up or rammed or whatever it was. And he was in incredible pain, and so he was taking all kinds of painkillers. He was taking steroids, which is why his face got so, if you look at his later years, his face is very kind of square and filled out. Early years, very lean. It wasn't that he gained weight, it's that he had this steroid face. And he was taking amphetamines to push through the grogginess from the painkillers.
Right.
And he was still a damn good president.
Yeah, well, I heard he also smoked weed for the back pain as well.
Heard that. I've never seen that written down anywhere. But the records of the pharmaceuticals right. that he's taken are no secret.
My point is that you know I think you know especially like someone like a president or something like that. I think it's you know actually if you're going to drug test welfare people,
I don't think we need to drug test anybody. You know, I think if somebody is if they're misbehaving and you want to find out why, are they drunk? Are they high? Are they schizophrenic? Do they have a mental illness? Are they, you know, did they bang their head too hard against the wall? I mean, you do the appropriate medical tests, but these should be medical issues. These should not be criminal issues.
Yeah, I just think if they're gonna have drug testing. I mean,
no,
I mean,
this is
get drug tested. So if they're gonna have the drug testing, I'm just saying that the people who make these laws and et cetera, should be under the same standard.
Yeah, no, this is just like this phony baloney guy who.
We should know the results. I mean, if you're in charge of an entire country, I think it's you know semi sensible to see if he's a wicked alcoholic kind of a thing.
Yeah.
You know, so if it's gonna be around, what's good for the goose is good for the gander.
Yeah. I disagree. I don't think there should be a goose or a gander, but I get your point. And it's like, you know, the guy who called in the last hour, at the end of the last hour, who's like, yeah, my wife went out last week and these people loaded up their cart with their food stamps and gave it to the drug dealer. And come on, give me a break. We have caller ID. I'll call you back tonight and talk to your wife. I mean, give me a break. These vanishing hitchhiker stories, these apocryphal stories, I know somebody who knows somebody who once pulled a gun on a carjacker in a parking lot, and therefore we should all have guns. I can't tell you how many people I know who are like gun enthusiasts who know somebody who knew somebody. And, you know, it's the same thing. It's like, come on, give me a break. Drug testing, this should be a medical issue, not a criminal issue. And it should have nothing to do with food stamps.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And if somebody is addicted to drugs, they have an illness, the same as if they have liver disease or cancer. That illness should be treated. It's not that you should cut off their food.
Oh, it's something I want to say.
How about you in the water cooler wars? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, man. Eric Holder, the Attorney General of the United States, you'll recall one of the right-wing wackadoodles, Republican appointees on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals earlier in the week, had an attorney who worked for the Department of Justice arguing something before him, and he just went off on this guy. It was the day after the president had made a comment about how to the press, somebody, you know, a reporter had said to President Obama, do you think that the Supreme Court is going to overturn Obamacare? And President Obama said, no, I don't think they will. I think they will defer to the, these are my words, not his, but it's the essence of what he said. He said, I think that they will defer to the will of the majority of the people and their elected representatives. And this judge just went ballistic and said to this kind of grunt lawyer, I mean, you know, it wasn't like he said it to the president or he said it to Eric Holder. He said it to one of their employees. Said, you will have within 48 hours a letter that is no less than 3 pages, single-spaced, on my desk, or I will hold you in contempt. So Eric Holder wrote the letter and said, we don't dispute judicial review. We don't dispute that the federal courts have the right to knock down laws because they say that they're unconstitutional. I wouldn't have written that letter. A, because I don't think courts should have that jurisdiction. And B, because I wouldn't have given a partisan right-wing wackadoodle judge the satisfaction. But what Holder's doing is it's an election year. And he's saying, you know, let's just cool this thing down. Put this fire out. We've got bigger issues to deal with than a crazy judge on the Fifth Circuit. So give him what he wants. You know, he probably had one of his lawyers write the thing, and, you know, it took a few thousand of your taxpayer dollars to respond to this crazy judge. And anyway. Bruce in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Bruce, thanks for listening to KBAI. What's up?
Well, hi, Tom. I think I came up with a hook in logic that disputes the fallacy of those who think there should be drug testing for welfare recipients. And that is what they suppose, if someone does test positive for drugs, is that they've spent the taxpayers' money on that. Mm-hmm. But just because they do test positive for drugs doesn't indicate they spent any money on those drugs. Right. They could be at a party, someone passes off a joint or a bong, and doesn't necessarily imply that money was spent.
No, this is entirely punitive, and B, it misses the biggest point, which a caller reminded me of earlier in the week, and I am eternally grateful for, which is that drug addiction is a disease. So if we're going to test welfare recipients for disease, I'm all in favor of it. Let's give them full health care. They can go in every year or every 3 months if that's what it takes. I mean, depending on their medical condition, and get mammograms or prostate exams or heart blood pressure checks or triglycerides. You go through the list. Colonoscopies, what are the things they recommend, you know, every couple of years? Check them out and see if they and if they have a problem with drug addiction, treat that too. I mean, these are things, I think that, you know, people who are so poor that they can't afford to buy food should have access to health care, including mental health care, which includes drug addiction health care. But you know, what these guys are doing is they're trying to portray these people as criminals and as freeloaders and because they're on food stamps. And it's absolutely wrong. That in and of itself is criminal, in my opinion, or at least morally criminal. Kitty in Charleston, South Carolina. Hey, Kitty, what's up?
Yeah, I wanted to go back to the president's speech at the AP luncheon the other day.
Yeah.
The best bit for me, because I guess it's my pet peeve, but the false equivalency reminder that he gave right to the media was the best part. Where, you know, and this relates, I think, directly back to where you were showing the Nixon and the JFK debate.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't the difference now that the media is really complicit in allowing candidates to lie?
Yes, absolutely. And you can see it on the Sunday morning shows every single week. You have somebody who pretends to be an actual news person who actually probably has a degree, in many cases, from an actual college that teaches journalism. And they sit there and a politician sits in front of them and tells a bald-faced lie. And they don't say, sir, the facts don't comport with what you said, or something equally civilized. Instead, they go, okay, now turning to other matters. And they just let it hang out there. They just let it stand there. And the reason that they do it is because they know that those Sunday morning shows will get fewer and fewer viewers if the big-name TV stars or big-name politicians who have become TV stars don't show up. And it's not just the necessarily politicians who have power. It's the Sarah Palins of the world. It's the Steve Kings of the world. It's the high profile politicians who have made spectacles of themselves, and therefore they draw eyeballs. They don't necessarily have to be the people who actually have power in this country. So it's all theater.
It's so irresponsible, and it's so detrimental to our democracy.
It absolutely is, and it didn't used to be that way back before 1987, when the FCC doctrine said that the news has to be the news, and entertainment is entertainment, and never the twain shall meet. Kitty, thank you for the call, but Ronald Reagan did away with that in 87, and we've been suffering ever since. Oneida in Sanford, Maine. Do I have that right?
It's Oneida.
Oneida. Hey, what's up?
I found an article in this week's edition of this week's In This Times,
mm-hmm.
and it blew my mind. A lawsuit by 13 Ogoni, indigenous people of Niger.
Yeah.
They brought a lawsuit against Shell, Dutch Shell.
Yes.
They brought it to the Supreme Court on February 28th.
Yes.
And it alleges that Shell caused environmental damage, devastation, and humanitarian.
Right. This is under what's called the Alien Tort Act, and it was argued before the Supreme Court that the argument that was made against it was that a foreign corporation shouldn't have to worry about being sued in a U.S. court.
Well, this is going to pit the SCOTUS ruling that yes, corporations are people. And the corporate or the court that the Tort Act says people of the corporations can be sued.
Right.
So
and
now it's going to have to decide.
Yeah, when this decision comes down,
the corporations.
It's going to be fascinating because let's hold our judgment on this. Oh, Anita, thanks a lot for the call and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Let's hold our judgment on this and we'll find out. We'll see what's going to go on. Victor in Seattle. Hey, Victor, thanks for listening to Talk 1090. What's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great.
I just want to let you know, I love your show. I listen to you all the time, and I try to get my friends and them to listen, but, you know, that's like pulling teeth, I guess. But, you know, a lot of my friends on my social network sites and whatnot, they're big GOP fans. They hate Obama. And I just they can never tell me really why they don't like Obama other than the talking points that you hear on Fox News.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, for the common man, if you're making less than $100,000 a year, Obama's your friend. I mean, he's more in your pocket or more on your side, I'll say, than the GOP. But what I called about was, people just don't realize what the GOP is doing. And this is a plan from the far right. They're going to try to pull it as far right as they can. And even though it won't go as far right as they want it to, once it gets as far as it'll go, it's going to bounce back, but it's not going to be anywhere near center.
No, and every generation it gets pulled a little farther to the right. As long as we have this doctrine that money is not property, it's speech, and the corporations are not figments of the law, they're people.
Right, exactly. And so, I'll be real brief. All I wanted to say was, you know, like I hear people talk about, well, drug tests, you know, the politicians should be drug tested then, and the welfare people should be drug tested. And I like the last caller who said, it doesn't mean the guy who tested positive and is on welfare use that money for drugs. I mean, you can't make that connection.
Right.
So I just think that even if 5%, 10%, your guy who screened me said it's 5%, but I thought maybe 10-15% of the population on welfare are drug addicts. I mean,
they found when they started testing them down in Florida about 6 months ago when they passed this law is that it's 2%.
And my point is that even if it's 15, that's not enough to where we need to say this is a huge problem. Yeah,
what it says is you've got 2% of the people down there in Florida who are suffering from the illness of drug addiction, and they need treatment. They don't need to have their food stamps cut off. You know, they need treatment. And if they don't get that treatment, their kids are going to suffer, they're going to suffer, their neighbors are going to suffer, society is going to suffer, and the Republican answer to this is cut off their food?
Right.
I mean, seriously, is that what you mean to tell me?
Right. It's such a selfish country. A lot of Americans have become in this country just so selfish and self.
It's like blinded almost. It's like numbed. They're not seeing or feeling. You know, they're losing empathy. Not feeling the pain or the experience of their fellow human beings. And it's a real tragedy. Victor, thank you for the call. This is just a huge tragedy in the United States. 2% of the people on welfare in Florida are using drugs. They have a medical condition. It should be treated. The Republican response, oh, they got a medical condition? Cut off their food. Tell me this makes sense. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. Don't forget, we've got a free app where you can get our daily stack, all links to all the stories, everything we talk about every single day over at the App Store. Tom Hartman.
What about now? What about today? What if you're making me
all that I was meant to be? So help us celebrate Ellen Ratner's birthday by going to goatsfortheoldgoat.com and help out actually a community in southern Sudan that is desperately in need. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, on the line with us. Hey, Ellen, what's going on in the world?
Well, okay, a couple interesting things. Let's just talk about the presidential race briefly, even though we don't do a lot of that. Mm-hmm. But apparently Santorum is having a little summit today, and the National Review apparently is reporting that he's getting together with some of his conservative people to re-engineer his campaign.
Hmm. Now, I understand that he's actually a couple of points ahead of Romney in Pennsylvania, but...
He was, and then another poll came out and showed him a few points behind.
Oops.
So the question is, if Romney comes in with a boatload of money, which it looks like he's got and can do, because if he wipes out Santorum, then, you know, it's clear sailing. So it's probably worth him to sink a lot of that money into Pennsylvania.
Ellen, I was reading... two different conservative websites over the last couple of days. I haven't talked about this on the air yet, and I'd love to run it by you. Both of them were suggesting that Rick Santorum is not actually running for president right now, that what he's doing is he's establishing his candidacy 4 years from now because he doesn't believe that Romney will beat Obama. And the tradition in the Republican Party is the guy who came in second in the primary, in the last primary, is the guy who's the presumptive nominee in the next primary.
You and I have probably been reading the same things. I 100% agree with it. The problem Santorum is going to have with that, in a normal scenario, that might be the scenario. The problem is that he's very anti-gay, and he's pretty anti-choice and anything like that. And this new group of young people will now be 4 years older. So the kids that are, you know, 16 will be voting age, not that they vote a whole lot, but the kids that are 20 will be 24, or the kids that are 24 will be 28, and et cetera. And they are going to think he's even more of a dinosaur than some of the people think now. So I right. think he's kind of out of luck.
Yeah, I think the other problem that he's going to face is that the A team didn't actually run for president this time because they just got out of the way of Romney because he was the presumptive nominee, or because they didn't want to go up against Obama. So Marco Rubio and Chris Christie and arguably...
Well, we always heard that Haley Barbour was going to make his assessment. This is the Mississippi gossip,
sure.
based on the fact whether he thought Obama was beatable. And if he didn't think he was beatable, he wasn't going to run.
Right, and he didn't. And a lot
right.
of Republicans, Jeb Bush, I guess, is probably the head of that pack. And if Jeb Bush runs 4 years from now, there's no way Rick Santorum can beat him in a primary, in my opinion.
Oh, that's for sure.
Yeah, so we'll see. Anyway,
okay.
back to the news.
It was interesting today at the White House, President Obama was asked about the Augusta National Golf Club that has the Masters Tournament because they don't admit women, and what the president thought about that. And basically, Jay Carney said, we're kind of a long past the time when women should be excluded from anything. And and basically, the president was asked, you know, whether he would play golf there, and clearly he would not. So that was kind of an interesting little thing that happened at the press briefing today. Also, you've probably been talking about the attorney general did follow through with that appeals court letter today, and they basically said, while duly recognizing the court's authority to engage in judicial review, the executive branch has often urged the courts to respect the legislative judgments of Congress. And the president's remarks, they said, were fully consistent with that principle, and that was Eric Holder.
Yeah, yeah, or an attorney writing on under his name.
Right, exactly,
yes.
exactly.
But I figure if this wasn't an election year, I was running the White House, I would have just ignored that crazy judge. But I think that what the president was trying to do is say, you know, let's not let this thing get out of control and divert people's attention away from really important stuff. Give the guy his damn letter. You know, have one of the lawyers of the DOJ throw it together. Have Eric Holder sign it. Get it out of the way. Get it done with.
Exactly. And that's what they did. And now what can they say, right? Yeah. He complied with the court order. Also today, a bunch of groups, Consumer Federation of America and some other folks, they've sort of put themselves together in a group called Americans for Financial Reform. They want stricter market standards, and they are also going after derivatives dealing with the price of gas. And it also looks like Maria Cantwell is beginning to put together some legislation dealing with swaps, you know, credit default swaps, all that kind of thing. She will, I submit it probably in a week and a half when she gets back to Congress.
That's great. She's very smart on those kind of things. So.
Yeah, and she's doing a pretty good job. Now, there's an interesting thing that has come up. Of course, the United Nations today went after Syria. They're giving them basically till the 10th or the 12th of April to comply and to withdraw from the cities and to have a ceasefire. And Kofi Annan, who's the former Secretary General, is the special envoy in this. Susan Rice said she doesn't believe that Syria is going to comply. But also, so that's sort of one piece of international news. The other piece of international news is, if you recall, Ray LaHood, who's the Republican member of the president's cabinet, basically was in Egypt and was denied the ability to leave. This is his son, because he was operating the National Republican Institute. There's a National Democratic Institute, National Republican Institute, and they're on this, you know, ballot freedom, all this stuff. So Hillary Clinton basically said, if you don't let these guys out, we're not giving you any money. They let them out. She gave them money. They turn around, and then they're going to Interpol and asking them to arrest various people on these as charges. And they want Interpol, of course, can arrest anywhere in the world. These are Americans mainly, and so they're asking them to arrest these people and bring them to Egypt for justice.
That's interesting. How's it going to play out?
Well, the Americans obviously aren't going to arrest the Americans.
Yeah.
And Interpol doesn't, it can't operate, you know, in other words, it has to be an American police that's a member of Interpol. So it's just not going to happen. But some nerve of Egypt.
Yeah. Well, on the other hand, was there a crime committed?
Probably not, actually.
I see. Okay. In that case, yeah, some nerve. Okay. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service and goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Check it out. Ellen, thank you.
Thank you.
Always great talking to you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, a couple things I want to talk about in this hour. I'm going to start out by just dropping a little thought bubble in your brain and let you roll it around a little bit, and we'll come back to it. The hit on Obamacare is that the government can't mandate you to buy something from a for-profit corporation. Okay. And by mandating, it would be like, you know, you'd have to pay a tax. Now, that's modest. I mean, if the government was really mandating things and you didn't do them, they'd put you in jail, right? Just consider the logic of this. That would be a real mandate, right? You must do it. It's like back during the Vietnam War. You are mandated to show up for selective service. If you don't, you go to jail. Okay. So here's the question. What if you choose not to wear clothes? Walk down the street naked. Is the government mandating that you buy clothing from for-profit corporations? Is that legal? Is the logic that these 26 state attorneys general brought before the Supreme Court basically the logic that could be used to justify national nudism? Think about it. Okay, now, I said a couple of topics. The other one is a lot more serious. Actually, that's quite serious. But this is really serious. back in 2002, and I've ever since the study came out. The study came out shortly after we started this radio program, and now a radio and TV program. But back at that time, I've been talking about this constantly because it just blew my mind when it came out. The BBC reported on the science of the relationship between political decisions, who's in power, who are the political decision makers, and rates of national suicide among the people. The headline, the BBC headline in this article in 2002 was "More Suicides Under Conservative Rule." We're talking the friggin' BBC here. This is, you know, they're not polemical. They're not political. This was not an editorial comment. This was an actual article, a news story in the BBC put up on their website. It was, you know, run as a news story on the broadcasting service, radio and TV. The first sentence of the article said, and I quote, "The suicide rate increases under conservative governments. The suicide rate increases under conservative governments, comma, research suggests." And then they talk about how they looked at virtually the entire 20th century, from 1901 to 1998, in both the UK and Australia. There was an impact that World War II had on suicide rates in the United Kingdom. And it caused them to go up. And there was an impact that droughts had in Australia during the 20th century, where it wiped out family farms and people committed suicide. But as the BBC reported, after adjusting for these factors, the figures clearly showed the highest rates of suicide occurred when both conservative state and federal governments were in power. End of quote. They also looked at what happened when the Liberal Labor Party, the equivalent of our Democratic Party, was in power. The conclusion reported by the BBC, quote, "Conversely, the lowest suicide rates occurred when state and federal governments were both Labor." In other words, like Democrats. They were able to actually pretty tightly pinpoint the numbers. Here's what the BBC reported. "When the conservatives ruled both state and federal governments, men were 17% more likely to commit suicide than when Labor was in power. Women were 40% more likely to kill themselves." Why might that be? The BBC cited the researchers as saying, "Conservative rule traditionally implies a less interventionist and more market-oriented policy than Labor rules. This may make people more detached, feel more detached from society." End of quote from the BBC, quoting these researchers. "Conservatives also make the rich richer and the poor poorer, which increases suicide rates." The BBC ended their article with these two very classically British understated, dry, blunt paragraphs. Quote, this is the end of the article. BBC, British Broadcasting Corporation, end of the article. "Overall," they say, the researchers that looked at the entire 20th century. "Overall," they say, "the figures suggest that 35,000 people would not have died had the conservatives not been in power, equivalent to one suicide for every day of the 20th century or two for every day that the conservatives ruled. The UK Conservative Party refused to comment on the research." Duh. You know, the Arab Spring began with a very public suicide of a street vendor in Tunisia. Soon after that, the government of Tunisia had fallen, and then Egypt, and then Libya. Now in Athens, a 77-year-old retired pharmacist left his daughter a suicide note in which he compared the banksters who have kicked out the democratically elected prime minister of Greece with those Greeks who collaborated with the Nazis during World War II. He pointed out how the banksters were stealing people's pensions. In Greece, even though it's a government program, they call it a pension program. The British call it a pension scheme. We call it Social Security. He pointed out that the banksters were stealing people's pensions the same way Republicans have worked to destroy Medicare and Social Security for generations here in the United States. In his suicide note to his daughter, he wrote, this 77-year-old pharmacist who shot himself in the head just a few hundred feet away from Parliament. He said, the occupation government literally, again, occupation, notice he's drawing that parallel to like the occupiers of, you know, the Nazi occupiers. He says, the occupation government literally annihilated any possibility for my survival that depended on a decent pension, which I personally paid for 35 years without any state support. Because my age does not give me the possibility for a dynamic reaction like picking up a Kalashnikov, I see no other solution than the decent end before I start searching in the garbage for food. This is a guy who was old enough to remember what happened to people who collaborated with Hitler, like Mussolini. He ended his suicide note with this. He said, I believe that one day the youth without future, he's talking about the young people today in Greece who are watching this trickle-down austerity wipe out their country, that the youth without future will take up arms and hang the national traitors upside down at Syntagma Square, the same as the Italians did with Mussolini in 1945 in the Piazza Poretto in Milan. End of quote. This all happened only a few hundred yards from the Parliament building and is setting off a whole new round of Greek protests against conservative trickle-down austerity and rule by banksters. Meanwhile, here in the U.S. last year, the Centers for Disease Control reported on a U.S. study of the 20th century that found suicide rates more than doubled during economic disasters like the Republican Great Depression. Bloomberg quoted the study's lead author, Fei-Jun Liu, an economist with the CDC, as saying, economic problems can impact how people feel about themselves and their futures, as well as their relationships with families and friends. It's truly tragic that it takes suicides to show us how destructive trickle-down austerity, conservative austerity programs are. And it's tragic that it's taking a second Republican Great Depression to wake Americans up to the need for a strong social safety net. We have our repeat of the Great Depression's bonus army. It's called the Occupy Movement. And suicides are up more and more as more and more people are being thrown out of their houses by banksters or denied health coverage by for-profit health insurance companies. We all need to work to expose the socially destructive nature of these trickle-down austerity programs like those that are being pushed right now by Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's just amazing. Please identify for me any country that cut its way to prosperity. You can't.
Well, it's that you found the same people you want on your way up, you might meet on your way down.
Yeah. That's a tough pill to swallow for a lot of people. Cora in Taos, New Mexico, listening on KVOT. Hey, Cora, what's up?
Well, Tom, I was going to comment about the police, but I did have one thing to suggest. I'm a great admirer of anthropologists, and I wondered if sometime you could speak to somebody about the premise you just laid out about the conservatives. Back in the early 70s, I read a book, which I bet you did too, Dr. Lauren Isley, The Immense Journey. And sometimes I think the anthropologist will have a grasp of the big picture that
we just aren't
getting.
I did not read that book. You want to give me the 10-second version of it?
Well, it's just a collection of his essays.
I see.
And it's just, you know, making us feel the part of the world, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I think an anthropologist might have a grasp of the larger picture.
Yes.
Just a suggestion.
Yeah, I agree.
But anyway, I was just going to say about the police in Albuquerque, the city of Albuquerque, since 2010, the police have shot 23 people, killing 19 of them. And in fact, two of them were just within the past 2 weeks.
Wow.
And it's a very large amount for the city the size of Albuquerque. And
yeah.
It was recently alleged that the police union has been paying these officers anywhere from $300 to $500 in cash to, quote, leave the city and decompress for a while.
Wow. I can't attest to the veracity of that, but what it does, you know, again, this goes back to the point, and Cora, thank you very much for the call. This goes back to the point of when we begin paying our cops and our teachers the way that we pay our doctors, then, you know, our future and our present will get a lot better. And I said this on the air the other day, and somebody went off on me about it on one of the message boards or something about, oh, you know, in those countries where they pay the cops and teachers as much as they pay the doctors only make $80,000 a year. Yeah. Actually, they make a little more than that, but, you know, 100, 120, 150 equivalent. And the cops are making 60 or 80. But, you know, I stand by that point. When you require the level of training, you need a calling. You know, people need to go into things because they love it, because they want to do it. Not because becoming an oncologist is the fastest way to become a millionaire outside of winning the lottery or being born as a member of the Lucky Sperm Club and having the right parents. So, anyway, we'll leave it at that. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Carl, what's up?
Hi, what's up, man? Listen, I find it quite ironic that the xenophobic, racist, hypocrites, better known as the Republican Party base, is now embracing judicial activists.
Yeah.
I sit and listen to Scalia use talking points from the people, not even trying to hide it. The judge, the appealing judge, Judge Smith, the one who sent out homework for Eric Holder.
Right, the Fifth Circuit Court judge.
This guy said Obamacare while he was sitting on the bench using Tea Party talking points. Yeah. And see, to me, this to me is going to wake up people around the country that may sit back and say, you know, the clown show of the Republican Party, we don't have to work that hard because Obama's going to win anyway. No, you must get out. You must get out now because we can make a difference. We can change what happened with Ronald Reagan on in making this an activist judge, an activist court.
Yeah, but just wait. I agree with your point, Carl. In fact, I would say wait until that money bomb hits. Karl Rove is out there. He's raised over $100 million. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has committed, I think, about a half of $100 million, $40 million
not
plus.
Not only that, Gillespie, the co-founder of Crossroads GPS, called Rove Super PAC, he is now the senior guy running. He's going to be running the campaign for Mitt Romney.
Right.
So we must. If you look at the court right now, there are a lot of old guys on that court right now, and they are hanging on.
And one old woman, too.
If John McCain been the president, more of those guys would have retired. They are hanging on just to see who's going to be the guy in next. And if President Obama wins this most important election coming up, we can actually change the course of this Republican, conservative, Tea Party, activist court that's been there since Ronald Reagan.
You are absolutely right. And this is where, Carl, people call me up and they go, oh, Obama didn't do this, Obama didn't do that. And my response is, maybe, but the Supreme Court, if nothing else, the Supreme Court is at risk. Marissa in Racine, Wisconsin, listening to WCPT. Hey, Marissa, what's up?
Hi. I have a couple comments, but the one that I wanted to comment on is the drug testing for people that get food stamps or any type of public aid. I have a sister who recently left her job where she's making decent money to take care of my parents because my mom is 76, my dad is 84. We didn't want to put them in a nursing home.
Mm-hmm.
So now because she's only making like $16,000 a year and she's a single parent, she has two kids, she has to go and get food stamps.
Mm.
And I just think like the thought about having somebody like that who is a decent human being, like, how humiliating is that? Because the thing is, if it was up to the Republicans and the way that they see people that are getting any type of help, they're all, you know, everybody's a welfare queen.
Yeah.
And that's not the case. And it's so disheartening that that's how they look at people that are actually down or that are trying to help somebody else. It breaks my heart because I think how much more humiliation our people are going to put through. I know that there's some abuse, but there's abuse everywhere. Why don't we start drug testing the bankers who are on welfare as well?
Yeah.
Why don't we say
No, no, let's not do more of a bad thing. Let's do none of a bad thing. Let's say if somebody has a drug problem, we're going to give them treatment for the drug problem as a medical condition. And if somebody needs food, we're going to get them food. Thank you, Melissa.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and the new vocabulary word, ugly. 527. Would be the good, the bad, and the very, very cultrivorously ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good, Walter Wilde. Walter Wilde helped form a group called Missoula Moves to Amend, which will soon be part of the National Move to Amend organization. Wilde and the rest of the founding members of the Missoula group want to end corporate rule in politics, not just in Montana, but all over the country. As Wilde said, when the Constitution talks about we the people, it certainly didn't include corporations. It's this type of grassroots activism that needs to continue if we want to restore our democracy and overturn the effects of Citizens United. Good on you, Walter, for being part of the movement. The bad. Arizona State Senator Judy Burgess. Burgess, along with other Arizona Tea Party members, has introduced a bill in the state legislature that could stop programs designed to help residents in that state become more energy efficient. Burgess said her goal is to wipe out any environmental program funded by the government to prevent social engineering, including where we live and what we eat. She believes in a conspiracy where clean energy programs in Arizona are a plot by the United Nations to create a single world government in order to control people's lives. Why doesn't she just admit her pockets are lined by big oil money instead? Or put on a tinfoil hat? And the very, very ugly... The Newport, California Police Department. Police were called to the home of Torrey Hunter, a professional baseball player, when his house alarm went off. When they arrived, they saw Hunter outside his house and drew their weapons. According to Hunter, the police asked for his ID because they didn't believe he lived there. This incident is the latest wave of racism across the nation. From the Trayvon Martin shooting to the death of Kenneth Chamberlain Sr., an elderly man shot in his own home by police. The idea that racism, which has already tarnished decades of American history, is on the rise again, is very, very ugly. Very, very ugly. Amazing. Steve in North Troy, Vermont. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Greetings from the home of the Northern Lights.
Thank you.
Yeah, this corporatism is fascism thing. The signs are all around us, you know, like on the back of a dime, the bundle of sticks.
Right.
And then
that's the fasce. But that, I mean, that symbol has been with us from the founding of this republic.
Yeah, this is true. And same with in the well of the House of Representatives.
Right. But the fasce with the bundle of sticks with a rope around it, symbolizing that, you know, one stick can easily be broken, but a bundle can't be, was the symbol of the Roman Empire. And
yeah,
when the founders put together this country, you know, our Constitution, they had three principal sources that they drew on. The Roman Empire, the Roman Republic, the Greek democracy, and the Iroquois Confederacy.
Confederacy, yep.
And so they use symbols from all of them. You will find symbology from all three of those, you know, littered across the landscape of late 18th century Americana and across the buildings here in Washington, D.C. So that doesn't mean that, you know, 200 plus years later when Mussolini decided to use the fasce, and
it was co-opted.
Yeah, he co-opted it, not the other way around. So I don't see the fasce being on the, you know, on the front of the being on the back of the dime or being on the front of the well of the Senate. Any indication that America is becoming fascist?
But with the Greeks, I mean, it's like the guy said, the pharmacist. It seems like, you know, the Germans are back. Only, you know, they're just back in banker form.
Well, it wasn't what he was. I mean, he might have been referring to the fact that the German government has been pushing really, really hard for these austerity measures in countries like Greece and Spain. But I don't know what was in his mind. My guess, though, is that he was just using that word, occupiers. There's actually a longer Greek word, and it's the name of the guy who was the prime minister during that time. They're equivalent of Vichy France, you know, whatever.
The only Greek word I learned from my friends is akristo, and it's spelled ex pieto, and it literally means junk.
Yeah. Well, the name that he used was like Quisling. Quisling was the guy in Norway, right? Who was the German collaborator. But my point is that I think what he was trying to say, although he could have been saying the Germans have some responsibility for this, I think mostly what he was trying to say is that he said the collaborators with the banks, you know, it's the banksters who have taken over his country. And it's true that the prime minister right now is an unelected bankster who was, you know, the elected guy was kicked out, Papandreou. And Papademos, the former head of the Greek Central Bank or whatever it was, you know, one of the major banksters, is now running the country.
You know, one of the biggest blemishes on U.S. history is the collaboration between American corporations and the Nazis. If you read Nazi Nexus by Edwin Black, or IBM and the Holocaust, it's unbelievable what these corporations did.
Well, go back and look at what, you know, Brown Brothers Harriman was doing back during that time, and Prescott Bush's involvement in it. But, you know, I'm reluctant to use the word fascist. Steve, thank you for the call. I'm reluctant to use the word fascist in reference to the United States or any of these countries right now. Fascism was started by Mussolini. It's the merger of corporations and state government. Yes, you can draw some parallels, but most Americans, when you say fascist, they think Nazism, and nothing like Nazism is going on. So, you know, Patty in Pacific Grove, California. Hey, Patty, what's up?
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so can you hear me?
I can. I hear you just fine.
Okay, so first of all, I want to say I'm a big fan, and you are a wealth of information of current events and of historical. I love that part, and I own every one of your books now.
Well, thank you. The kind words to open a call are not at all necessary. I appreciate it.
Okay, well, I just was writing down. So I wanted to talk about the police and the civil rights violations, mm-hmm. which I would have never believed occurred until due to some events in my life, which were not, I didn't do anything really bad. I had a boyfriend that was bad. And it turned it around because he was in a police family. And the degree to which I see police corruption and police overrunning civil rights, human rights, and then now killing people. I mean, I remember during the Rodney King riots. I mean, they didn't kill him. They beat him up pretty bad. But now they're killing people, and there's no riots. I mean, there was a lot of people walking, but people are getting desensitized. It's just a normal thing. And I think that more than money, which is a wonderful thing. Money is a wonderful thing, and they should be paid, and I believe in all that. But
well, along with money comes standards. I'm not saying you go into a current modern-day police department and say, okay, we're going to triple everybody's pay. I'm saying we're going to double or triple the standards, the hoops you have to jump through, the credentialing that you have to have,
right.
And then you will be paid appropriately for that.
And I agree, and I completely agree with that. I'm just, you know, at this point, I think there's, you know, I think about this all the time. What should all these grassroots organizations do? Mm-hmm. Maybe they should all unite and stop fighting their own, like everybody's fighting a different fight, but right. And fight for one or two things and then go and splinter off once they get the civil rights back into order and the corporations and the Supreme Court and what's it called, voter, campaign funding,
right.
Which is a big thing. But there's so many violations going on, and believe me, I live it right now. I live it where I never grew up this way. My mom's a nurse. My dad was a contractor. My mom's from Peru. My dad from Newark, New Jersey. He was in World War II and all that, and I'm only child. I was never treated as bad as I have been in watching my rights be overrun for the past 7 years. It is the most scary feeling you can ever imagine in your life.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to say that, and so
okay.
I would hope that – I just want to say that you are doing a great service, and anyway, that was it.
Okay. Thanks a lot. I appreciate the call, Patty. Thank you very much. Well said. Mike in Waukegan, Illinois. Hey, Mike, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hey, Tom, glad to have you on here live in Chicagoland now, you know, and it's another
pleasure.
Excellent show. Yeah, I just want to respond to the lady who thought that, you know, that the politicians should be drug tested, you know. Does she really think that for example, a paranoid, hardcore alcoholic president who was embroiled in a major political scandal of his own making, who joked about blowing up the world and whose delirium trembling index finger was just inches away from the red doomsday button, compares to, for example, the janitor who works in a corporate building who may, because he's stoned, commit the unpardonable sin of forgetting to empty the waste paper baskets in the corporate offices?
Yeah, no. And my, I will keep making this point. Drug addiction is a disease.
Yeah.
And if somebody, whether they're on government assistance or whether they're the president of the United States or whatever they may be, if they have a disease, if they have an illness, a mental and physical illness, and there's probably both components to drug addiction, they should be treated. You know, the answer is not to say, oh, we're going to punish people by making them pee in a cup every month, and if it comes back positive, we're going to cut off their food stamps. The answer is to say everybody has access to physical and mental health care, which includes treatment for drug addiction, whether it's a multimillionaire like Rush Limbaugh or whether it's that janitor you just posited. And
right.
If somebody's hungry, we give them food.
And I would say Richard Nixon when and so that's who I was obviously talking about.
I thought you were talking about George Bush.
Oh no. Well, it could have been him as well. But he exhibited such aberrant behavior. I think he deserved to be drug tested.
Yeah. Well, Richard Nixon was pretty clearly paranoid, particularly if you believe Henry Kissinger. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah. I mean, the point is. Well, I guess the point has been made. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
By the way, the Republicans have hired a fancy lawyer to fight against gay marriage. Guess who's paying for it? You and me.
From the war against disorder.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, and Sonia in Los Angeles. Hey, Sonia, what's up?
Hi, I just wanted to respond to a question that you posed to the public about raising taxes on millionaires.
Right.
And you put the question out, how much is that a week or a day, so forth.
Right.
And I did the math, it's $19,000 plus a week. And
wow.
I just wanted to make that statement. I mean, how much money do you need? Thank you for your show. You're intelligent, and I truly enjoy, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure, and thank you for doing the math. So $19,000 a week. Here, what we're talking about here is what's called the Buffett rule, and there's actually a name for it. Let me find the name. It's by the way, Sheldon Whitehouse and Charles Schumer, and in the United States Senate, and U.S. Representative Tammy Baldwin in the House of Representatives. It's called Paying a Fair Share Act. It's going to receive a Senate vote on the eve of tax day, so that must be like April 14th. And it basically says if you earn over $1 million, if you earn over $1 million from, you know, up to that $1 million, let's say that you're earning it the way Warren Buffett earns it or the way that Mitt Romney earns it. Mitt Romney earned, what was it, $14, $15 million last year? Let's say that you earn it the way that they earn it. The checks just come in the mail. It's dividends. It's the result of you owning stock in a corporation. The company declares a dividend, declares a profit. They split it up with their stockholders. So you're getting checks in the mail. That's how Mitt Romney makes a living. And, okay, Mitt, on your first $1 million, you pay a maximum 15% income tax because that's the top capital gains rate right now for millionaires. Now, the average working stiff, they can pay up to 36%, 35%, 36%, whatever it is. But you, Mitt, you can pay that maximum 15%, no problem. This is what the president's proposing. But after your first million, on the $1 million and first dollar, that $1 million and first dollar, you're going to pay 35% tax on. The same as, you know, a family where you've got a couple of people making a decent salary and and you know, keeping a household together at, you know, a little over $100,000 a year, where they're hitting the top tax rate. So, Mitt, pay up. Pay the same as working class people or upper middle class people, whatever you want to call it. And so if Mitt Romney made $14 million on his first million, he only pays 15%. Right now he's like paying 14.9 total. He's got some deductions there because he gives 10% to the church and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, on his first million, he's only paying 15%. But then on his 13 next million, he pays 35%. I don't see what's wrong with that. And as our caller just pointed out, $19,000 a day in income. Can you imagine every single day looking at your bank account and seeing, oh, hey, there's $19,000 more in there than there was yesterday. How can you spend that? Gee, I think I'll go first class to Europe. Well, that's like $7,000. Round trip. Well, I'll stay at a five-star hotel in downtown London. Well, that might be $500 or $1,000 a night. But you're making $19,000 every single night. That's $19,000 showing up in your checking account. How can you spend that? Oh, I think I'll buy a brand new Mercedes. Okay, that's 3 days' income. It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. James in Chicago. Hey, James, what's up?
I just want to let you know, I'm on Social Security disability, permanently disabled. And when I first applied, I applied for, I'm bipolar. But that wasn't enough to get it. And it turns out my diagnosis is polysubstance abuse was what made it enough to get me my disability.
So you're an example of the system saying you are a drug addict, that is a disease, we're going to treat it as a disease and take care of you. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
Okay, well, that's a good thing. I think that's a marvelous thing. Thanks a lot for the call, James. That's how we should be responding to it, not, oh, you're poor, you want food stamps? You're a drug addict? No, sorry. Be hungry. Rob in Trenton, New Jersey. Hey, Rob, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Great. How you doing, Rob?
Great, great. Good listening to your show, man. I think you're very informative, and if not for you and a few other people on XL, I wouldn't know a lot of stuff right now. But I called because, you know, what are the parameters they have with big corporations, you know, filling out applications, trying to get a job these days.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they may look 15, 20 years, you can see your history, to where you can't get a job.
Right.
And that has a direct effect on people going to the welfare system because where am I supposed to go?
Right. And this is Franklin Roosevelt said it, you know, so elegantly in 1933. He said the best welfare program is a job. Simple. And you know, the government should be the employer of last resort. If we have people in this country who are not working, Roosevelt also said in the year before he died when he laid out his second Bill of Rights, he said that we should, in the United States, we should say that you have the right to a job. And if the corporate environment will not provide it to you, then the government will. And
because
there's plenty of things out there that need to be done, that can be done, that can be paid for with taxpayer dollars. We've got a lot of infrastructure. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm sorry for cutting you off.
It's okay.
But I was also going to say, you know, with the suicide rate that you were talking about earlier, just right in my town in Trenton, you know, there was a lot of people when that stock market thing went down that stuck right in front of the train.
Yeah.
So I believe that statistic is right because I saw it. I had to go through it, going to work every day.
Yeah, it is truly tragic. It really is. Thanks a lot for the call, Rob. I appreciate it. And, you know, good point. Tomorrow is Friday. Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders will be here, the guy I think of as America's senator, although the Vermonters like to call him their own, and with good reason, having been a Vermonter myself. And, of course, anything goes Friday. We'll be taking your calls on whatever you'd like to talk about. And, plus, I'll have the news of the day and all that kind of stuff. But don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get active. Get involved. Occupy something. Tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.